we're talking about the architecture of dorms, their evolution over several centuries, and how their designs impact social connections. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Res halls, when done right, can provide a sense of community, right, within a larger university, perhaps even give a student an important networking leg up for their future career. Did you attend college? Did you live in a campus dorm? For how long? And was it co-ed? Did you have community bathrooms? Did you have a phone on your floor? What was the experience like? Did you love it, hate it? 800-642-1234. Carla Yanni is a professor of architectural history at Rutgers University, and she's the author of the new book, Living on Campus, An Architectural History of the American Dormitory. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. Carla, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So you looked at dorms through the centuries, from 1700s to today, and you arrive at this comment to say that, you know what, dorms really haven't changed all that much. Why do we say that? What is so common about dorm design?
Well, it's interesting because although students have changed drastically in 300 years, the idea in the United States that the collegiate experience is enhanced by students living together in a communal living arrangement, that goes back to the 18th century, to the colonial era. Most of the ancient universities of Europe, Uppsala and Bologna, they didn't have residence halls. It's Oxford and Cambridge that emphasized that residential piece, and Americans picked up on that.
So what were dorms designed to do? Was it just for student housing? What was their purpose?
In the colonial era, colleges had a very important social function because, you know, Americans didn't have that long established class system like in Britain. And Benjamin Franklin, in fact, said that we should bring our best young people together to make connections for business and for marriages. So the idea was really networking. But at that time, it was networking for young men so that they could meet other young men like themselves.
And so in order to network, though, the architecture of the building plays into that. What can we learn through architecture about dormitory life?
Well, I found it to be a logical extension of my book on the architecture of lunatic asylums. Not necessarily to be flippant about it, but any kind of communal housing, the architects need to consider questions of ventilation and surveillance. And when I wrote a book on 19th century psychiatric hospitals, I learned that the buildings were considered to be part of the cure, that the buildings were going to change behavior. And dormitories in the 19th century, and really up till today, are not that different. The people who build them feel that if you live in the building, it will make you a better person. It will be character building. That was certainly the argument up until about 1968, when things shifted dramatically.
Well, we're going to get into skyscrapers and quads and all of that, but what does the layout of a residence hall say about a building's character and who lives there?
Originally, the students lived in a multi-purpose building, so one big kind of rectangular building that had classrooms and professors' offices and a library and a chapel and some sleeping rooms. But quickly, the men's dormitories tended to be something like a quadrangle, the square donut shape, with lots of individual entrances. So the men would go in a door and up a staircase. So that's sometimes called the staircase plan or the entryway plan. In contrast to that, women's dormitories almost never used the entryway plan. They usually had one main entrance so that somebody could watch that entrance and see who was coming and going. Because there was this idea that women needed to be watched more closely. They needed to be protected from the outside world. So just there, by looking at the way the spaces are arranged and looking at the what architects call the plan of the building, you can see the difference in the way the buildings worked and who lived there and what their experiences were like.
We're talking with Carla Yanni. She's a professor of art history at Rutgers, and she's the author of the new book, Living on Campus, An Architectural History of the American Dormitory. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Did you live in a dorm on campus? For how long? What was the structure like? The architecture, was it co-ed? Did you have community bathrooms? What was the experience like? Did you love it or find community or not like it? You can call in with your stories at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. So, Carla, UW-Madison has, a lot of meat in your book, influenced the evolution of dorms significantly there at the beginning of the 1900s. UW President Charles Van Hise introduced quadrangles on campus. Where did this concept of quads come from?
Well, Van Hise was very influenced by Oxford and Cambridge. In fact, he made a rather extreme statement that the residential colleges of Oxford and Cambridge gave rise to the British Empire. He really felt that living together and eating together, worshiping together, studying together, that residential relationship is what made boys into men. It made them into better citizens. And he wanted to bring that to Wisconsin. For about two generations, UW had not built any dormitories for men. That meant that the men lived in boarding houses in town. And it was hard to create community in boarding houses. The boarding houses were cold, the food was bad. And it was during that period that fraternities really rose up as a better option for housing. But fraternities were only available to the wealthy students. So at UW, the idea was to create a dormitory that would be a democratic alternative to the fraternity. And the examples of that are Adams and Tripp Halls.
So Adams and Tripp Halls, and these were courtyards, the enclosed courtyards divided into small houses so that boys would form bonds, like family bonds. Is that right?
Exactly. I love those little buildings. They're just, the color of the stone and the texture, and they're not too tall and they're not too big. And when you're inside the courtyard, it's almost like being in an outdoor room. I mean, obviously, it's open to the sky, but you really feel kind of enclosed, and they have their own little porter's lodges. So, yes, the idea was to create a kind of cozy, almost like a series of houses, row houses in a way, around a square courtyard open to the sky.
So you have to walk through the courtyard in order to get into the building. You can't enter outside the courtyard.
Correct. Exactly.
We're talking about student housing, the design of dorms, how they impact student connections, their ability to network, find community. Rutgers University architectural history professor Carla Yanni is our guide. Her new book is called Living on Campus. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do you attend UW-Madison? Do you live in a quad? What do you think of quad-style living? Would you recommend it to prospective students? Perhaps you're a high school student attending college next year. Are you planning on living in a dorm? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment, right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about residence hall architecture through the ages here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author Carla Yanni writes, dorm living is one of the most widely shared experiences in modern American life. Hundreds of thousands of students pass through residence halls, and their lives are changed by their encounters with these buildings. The book is called Living on Campus, An Architectural History of the American Dormitory. You can join in 800-642-1234. Do you work for a university or college in Wisconsin? Have you seen college dorms evolve? Do you think college students should live on campus for part of it or all of their college career? What benefits do you see? Join in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. And Rutgers University art history professor Carla Yanni stays with us this hour. Carla, we were talking about quads there. Wanted to get more into bridging class divides. We read about Wisconsin architect Arthur Peabody in your book, who designed Camp Randall, and he really followed through with the quad concept. What did he know there?
It's interesting. The idea was to try to create within the dormitory the kind of esprit de corps that the fraternities had. So they produced a brochure attracting students to live in Adams and Tripp halls when they were new.
This is 1926.
Yes, in the 1920s. And they thought that they could bring the son of the banker and the farmer's boy together in front of a crackling fire to talk about the news of the day, and that it was living together that would create an environment where that would have the effect of kind of leveling class differences. So we see in this, an idea that what you learn in the classroom is fine, that's okay, that the academics are certainly part of college, but the part where you shape a person, a boy into a man, takes place outside the classroom. It's all those many hours of extracurricular activities and clubs and the band and the glee club. That's the part of the collegiate experience that shapes the character of a young person. And we still have that today when, you know, university administrators talk about leadership and building leadership skills. It's kind of an extension of that notion of character building.
Right. One administrator told you that students spend 80% of their time outside the classroom. So a lot of that time is living in a dorm.
That's right. Student affairs experts and student affairs administrators run a very large part of any institution, and they're guiding principle is to create an atmosphere that is helpful for student development. I mean, some people find that amusing because they only got into trouble when they lived in the dormitory. But the sort of official reason for the existence of the dormitory is to expose students to greater diversity and to give them opportunities for self-government and so on.
Greater diversity, there was Carson Gully from 1927 to 1954, UW-Madison's head chef. He later became the first African-American TV chef. And during his time at the UW, he lived on campus, even though it wasn't common for a black man to do so. How did this break racial barriers for Wisconsin?
Well, you know, in the Jim Crow era, it would have been nearly impossible for him to find housing near the campus as an African-American man. And so the university provided him with an apartment in Adams. And, you know, you can interpret that in two ways. I mean, that they gave him a place to live with his family, and that was nice, and he was in a building with white people. But on the other hand, it wasn't the basement, and it wasn't the most lavish of accommodations. But he was a very highly regarded person on campus. The dining hall, that little dining hall next to Adams and Tripp, is now named after him. And he later was an important founding member of the NAACP in Madison.
Let's go to Bill now, joining us from Trempealeau County. Hi, Bill.
Hi there. I was a resident in Adams Hall in the 1970s. I found it a unique experience. I'm happy to say that three of my lifelong friends I met through living in that dorm. I had lived in other college dorms before that. Very different experience. Kind of like, it seemed like public housing in sometimes. Whereas Adams and Tripp, were very pleasant places to live. And I have to tell you that as a member of a large blue-collar family, living in Adams Hall was the first time I had a single room, which despite despite having a beloved brother, it was nice to be in a single room for the first time in my life. I had to wait a semester to get that, but I was extremely lucky, and I think it really helped my college career, the privacy and the ability to concentrate. But it was, these were small houses, as we call them. They're about the size of about 40 people or so. So you got to know everybody you wanted to know. They had a quite pleasant atmosphere. The house fellow, of course, had a room with a fireplace in it. We had a fireplace in our den, which we sometimes actually used, but it was a good meeting place. So I have wonderful memories of UW-Madison, where I went both as an undergrad and then later law school. But I think that living in that smaller dorm eased my transition onto a big campus. I transferred in when I was a sophomore. And I think it led to, as I said, some lasting friendships.
Yeah, transition to adulthood there, and especially having that having that own room to himself. Well, Bill, thank you so much for that call. Carla, what do you hear there as Bill talked about Adams?
That's delightful. I'm very pleased to hear that his experience was exactly what the designers back in the 1920s had hoped for. It does remind me that one of the changes over the last couple of decades, and I'm sure that the caller has probably observed this, is that his experience going from, let's say, a crowded working class household with lots of brothers and sisters and sharing bedrooms as a child, and then getting to college and having a single, is the reverse of what many college students experience today, which is that as suburban houses have gotten much bigger, children growing up often have their own bedrooms. They often sometimes even have their own bathrooms. So then they're actually going down a step to move to college campuses, live in a traditional dormitory in a double or a triple and share a bathroom with people down the hall. That's a really big shift, and it's a very tough sell for some of the residence life people at universities with old housing stock.
Let's go to Judith in Hixton now. Judith, hi.
Good morning. Thank you. I am going to actually resonate the previous caller. I very skeptically moved into a dormitory at UW Stevens Point and met some of the most wonderful people in the world, and we have remained friends for over 40 years. We're actually getting together this weekend. And so I've had a tremendous experience, and I've also worked as an academic advisor for many, many years. And within my own family, nieces, nephews, now great nieces, nephews, I encourage everybody to spend at least 1 year in the dormitory.
Judith,
I had an amazing experience.
Judith, may I ask you, was it a co-ed dorm at UW-Stevens Point?
No, that was too racy back in the day. It was every other floor.
I don't mean so to date you. Right.
That's okay. I did myself with the 40 years. No, first floor was women, second men, third women, fourth men.
Well, Carla, co-ed universities date back to the 70s, but where did we see universities go with the co-ed experience?
Yes, that's a long and interesting question. As Midwesterners know, but some Easterners do not know, big universities like Wisconsin and Michigan and Iowa were co-ed in the 1870s. But that didn't mean that men and women lived in the same buildings. that would come much later in the 1950s, is when I can find examples of men and women actually living in the same building. But there was almost always some kind of mechanism to keep the men away from the women and vice versa. I saw it in one case done with these pedestrian bridges that funneled the men to one side of the building and women to the other side, and in another case with special elevators. But I'm guessing what your caller was referring to was a dormitory that already existed. And then when it was socially acceptable in that community for men and women to live in the same dorm, they just made one floor women and one floor men. So they didn't make any architectural changes.
We're talking with architectural history professor Carla Yanni. She stays with us through the hour. Her new book is called Living on Campus. Are you a parent of a current college student or recent grad? What were their dorms like? How different are they compared to when you went to school? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll explore the role of dorms today and their influence on higher education. It's coming up after a news update. Stay with us here in the Ideas Network. We're looking at the significance of residence halls on how students live and learn and build a community around themselves. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Carla Yanni writes, residence halls are not mute containers for the temporary storage of youthful bodies and emergent minds. Dorms constitute historical evidence of the educational ideals of the people who built them. Regardless of good intentions, there are plenty of boxy dorms out there, students packed into living arrangements very close to each other. Carla Yanni traces this history and these architectural ideas. Her new book is called Living on Campus, gathering your insights along the way, your reflections on dorm life, 800-642-1234. Are you a high school student attending college next year? Are you planning to live in a dorm? Why or why not? Are you currently in a college dorm? And how is that going? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go to Lola now, joining us from Madison. Good morning, Lola.
Hi. I was just going to say that my college dorm experience was one semester, and it was horrible. I graduated high school in January, so it was early. And so I went to Arizona State, and they put me in with another girl who also graduated early. And that was the only thing we had in common. I was a journalism major. She was an engineering major, so that's kind of like polar opposites. Nothing in common. And we had the suite arrangements. We had two girls on one side, two girls on the other in a shared bathroom. The whole thing would have been lovely if it hadn't been for personalities. Our suite mate was, I don't know what her issue was, but she played Bridge Over Troubled Water 24/7 on her stereo. This was in 1970. And she would go away for the weekend and leave it going. And I couldn't listen to that song for years. I swear, I would twitch, you know? And I can't listen to it now without thinking about it. And so they didn't give a lot of consideration into, like, you know, interests and personalities. They just thought, oh, you two graduated at the same time. We'll just put you together. And then doesn't work. So
Lola, where did you move to? Where did you move to when once you got out of the dorm after a semester or quarter or whatever?
Oh, I went back to the University of Arizona instead.
Okay.
That summer, because I went to summer school, I had a private room and it was fabulous.
Oh, so you went to, went to a private room situation and that worked out much better.
Yeah. And then I was in my own place after that, off campus after that. So mostly it was off campus when I was in, and then I got married and then I was fully off campus, but yeah.
Well, we'll try not to queue up Bridge Over Troubled Water here to torture you further. Thank you so much, Lola. Carla, what do you hear there?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that Lola's experience, well, she was introduced to people who were different from herself, at least in terms of musical taste repetitive musical taste. But in a way, it was a learning experience for her, right? I mean, and she solved the problem 4 months later. She was out of there and moved on. I mean, single rooms are attractive to students. They're But in terms of student development, I think most residence life experts really prefer that first-year students live in doubles because it, well, it doubles the social network, assuming that you socialize with your roommate and your roommate's friends. But it can be a very rough transition. It's a small space. You know, dormitories are intimate spaces. It's not the same as sitting next to someone in a classroom or sharing a bench in a laboratory. This is a, you know, you're changing, you're dressing, you're going to the bathroom down the hall. All of that's a very intimate arrangement. And so these roommate situations have a kind of hothouse atmosphere. You know, emotions run high.
So before dorms, fraternities and boarding houses were the options for students. Take us back to the early days of fraternities and what their purpose was.
Fraternities started out as literary and philosophical societies. So in the first part of the 19th century, the only subjects that boys studied in college, and I say boys because they were younger, they were maybe 14, 15, 16 years old. The only things they studied were theology, classics, and math. If they wanted to talk about literature or what they'd read in the newspaper that day, they did that on their own time, and they formed these literary societies, and the literary societies had Greek names, and they were a little bit like debating societies, and those eventually evolved into secretive, all-male societies that were sort of like the Masons or the Odd Fellows. And then the next step in the 1870s after the Civil War was for fraternities to live together. So the residential all-male white fraternity comes about in the 1870s, and they really took the collegiate world by storm. The increase in the numbers happened very, very fast.
And I learned through your book that hazing was an issue back then, pretty extreme. It's not just today.
Yeah, sadly, hazing existed between class years. So the sophomores hazed the freshmen, but then the fraternities picked up on it and used hazing as part of initiation rites. And back in 1872, a Cornell student fell into the gorge. He was blindfolded at the time.
So as colleges continue to deal with the challenges of hazing and drinking-related deaths, do you think there is a future for Greek life on campuses?
Well, I think the question of the future of fraternities should probably be best decided locally, you know, at each individual university, because universities have very different cultures around fraternities, white male residential fraternities, and the fraternities have different histories on different campuses. My colleagues in student affairs, who are far more expert on this than I am in terms of understanding the day-to-day lives of Greek affiliated students, is that they often argue that it's better to keep the fraternities on campus and have them participate in the life of the university, because sometimes when they're banned, they go underground and criminal activities become even more intense, and then the university has no influence over them.
We're talking with Carla Yanni. She is a professor of architectural history at Rutgers University and author of the new book, Living on Campus, An Architectural History of the American Dormitory. You can join in with your experiences of dorm life, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Rachel now, joining us from Viroqua. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
So what's on your mind about your dorm?
Well, I loved my dorm. I went to University of Iowa, and I lived in Currier, one of the old dorms, and I just loved it. And it, you know, my first room, it was just with an assigned roommate, and it was really small. But we were not very compatible at all, and ended up we switched roommates amongst a couple of us on the floor, and that ended up happening at it was first midterms of freshman year, which was not a good timing, and I ended up moving in with somebody, though, that she's still a friend, and she's still a very good friend, and it was just a good experience. I got to meet lots of people. I come from a large family, so I was used to sharing my room a lot and not having much space of my own. But
Rachel, can you describe what your dorm looked like? It was an old dorm, but what did it look like?
It's a stone building. It's a big, big U. One arm of the U is all women. One arm of the U is all men. And the middle U is co-ed, or at least it was back when I was there. And I ended up, we were in a tiny room my first year, and then my second year we were in sort of a medium room, and then third and fourth year, my roommate was 1 year ahead, and so we got higher status in the room selection. So we got one of the really cool corner rooms that ended up being two rooms, which was really neat, and we kept those. So,
well, thank you so much, Rachel. Carla, what do we know about U-shaped design in dorms?
Well, it's related to UW's campus, because Adams and Tripp were these tightly, completely enclosed quadrangles, they offered no view of the lake, even though they're right next to the lake. And so they were criticized, although they were admired and widely published, but there was at least one person who criticized them for by shutting off that the end of the U and making a complete square, they didn't have views of the lake. So the U or the E or the H-shaped plan, those are all kind of variations on the quadrangle, and you can find them on it almost any college campus. I thought she described her dormitory very well, though.
You know, administrators hope that dorms would teach students how to live democratically, and you've touched on this, but they haven't always lived up to those ideals. How have dorms struggled to keep up with societal changes?
Yes, they're a site of contestation across the decades. Often there were cases, for example, where the deans of women, who tended to be quite progressive, wanted African-American students to be allowed to live in the dormitory with white students. I'm thinking now of a particular case at the University of Chicago around 1905. And the president overruled the deans of women and asked the African-American woman to move off campus. So it has not always been a perfect experiment by any stretch of the imagination. But overall, as a kind of laboratory for social interaction, they, as we've heard from your callers, a lot of people have made lifelong friends in residence halls.
Students spend a lot of their time out of class in their dorm. The design of residence halls where students live and socialize and study happening, all those things happening outside of the classroom. We're looking at the architecture through the centuries, getting your insights, your memories of dorms along the way. 800-642-1234. Carla Yanni is a professor of architectural history at Rutgers University. And her new book is Living on Campus, An Architectural History of the American Dormitory. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Seem to have strong opinions about dorm life. We're exploring their architecture this hour, how dorms are designed, and how the design informs how students interact with each other. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is called Living on Campus, and author Carla Yanni is our guide to dorms past and present. Let's go back to the phones now with Scott joining us from Spooner. Hi, Scott.
Hello. Good morning.
What about your dorm?
So I lived in a older dorm in a private college in Minnesota. And I was paired up freshman year with someone who couldn't possibly have been more different from me. He was from the Iron Range of Minnesota and active in the Young Republicans. And I was an Eastern liberal. And, you know, it could have been a disaster, but because we had to live so closely together, we just figured out a way to work it out. And I mean, I'm 60 years old now. And I'm still, he and I have become lifelong friends. In fact, this weekend, we try to get together several times a year. We each drive halfway, and we spend the weekend doing yoga with each other, which couldn't have been more, you know, nobody would have ever predicted that either one of us would remain friends. But it worked out, and I just think dorm life is really, really important to the growing up process.
How long did you live in a dorm, Scott?
The entire time that I was at college, I left after 2.5 years I wanted to try farming, so I did that. But the entire time I was at college, I was in a dorm, and I'm glad I was.
Thank you for that story, Carla. You know, Scott there finding common ground with someone who was his polar opposite.
Right. It's interesting. I'm guessing that the college he went to randomly assigned people roommates, but maybe not. Something that concerns me a little bit at the moment in terms of roommates is that there are these services that allow incoming first year students to select a roommate, like kind of like a dating app, like Match.com or something. And that means they're kind of pre-sorting themselves. So for one example that was given is, well, if two young women are both rushing sororities, then they might want to live together because that's such a time-consuming process. But obviously, if you sort out the students before they get there by who's rushing a sorority, you're already limiting the diversity, which is supposed to be the raison d'etre of the residence hall. So I like these stories about lifelong friends who came together because of the randomness of the pool.
Let's go to Verna now in Duluth. Verna, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What is your story?
Well, I want to offer a different perspective from as being a graduate of a historically black college and university. And I think that the dormitory structure is very different with respect to minority institutions. They're obviously the hub of social life, and they also bring into a different dynamic and perspective, especially for those like me in their later 50s and older, whereby there was little to no other option other than living in a dormitory because of segregation. So we were all pretty much protected in the dormitory structure by basically law if we were attending a school. And also, it was a social hub by which sororities, fraternities, and other, social clubs were joined together. And, of course, I did form lifelong friends. Another perspective is that the dormitory culture in historically black colleges and universities tend to be a little more protective in terms of we had dorm mothers. And there were certain rules, such as curfew. And there was, you couldn't have male visitation in your room. We had parlors. So I think that to bring to this conversation a different perspective is important. And again, there's an economic factor even till today. Many minority students lack the finances to find off-campus housing, so they're pretty much obligated to have on-campus residential living and housing.
Excellent points, Verna. Thank you so much for that. Carla, what do we see at HBCUs?
Well, part of one of the buildings I studied in some depth is the Harriet Tubman Quadrangle at Howard, which is a women's dormitory. And everything that the caller mentioned is absolutely true. I mean, Howard students and the dean of students at the time, Lucy Diggs Slow, who is a nationally renowned educator, she stated very clearly to the students that you are being watched and you need to be on your best behavior because the white neighbors are judging you as representative of the race. So the protection of the students, making sure that dormitory life at historically black colleges and universities is controlled. The students were under a watchful eye for decades longer than white universities that could in some ways not have to worry about that. So It is a very important perspective, one I touch on in the book, but certainly could do more with.
Let's try to bring in one more voice here, Lisa in La Crosse. Lisa, hi.
Hi, hello. I actually work in residence life at a public institution, and I love dorm life so much I decided to make it my career. And I agree with many of the things your callers have said and the things your guests have said about students really taking random roommates and the wonderful relationships that can come from that. I also just wanted to share, we find on our campus our older traditional residence halls that have, you know, a double-loaded corridor, standard two-person bedrooms with the shared community bathroom. Although that's not students' first pick, we absolutely find that first-year students living in those halls have a much higher level of satisfaction as far as community building, as far as meeting new people. Our newer residence halls that are suite style and don't have as much of that forced shared interaction, we tend to not put first-year students there because they aren't able to make as many connections as they can in one of our older halls.
Lisa, thank you so much for those observations, which I think segues, Carla, into what I want to ask is we've seen criticism today that dorms are getting too opulent, right? There are climbing walls in them. There's lazy rivers going through the front. Have we gotten too big with our ideals of what dorms should be? And should we go back to these smaller community spaces?
That's as you say, a perfect segue. I think this toothpaste is out of the tube. There's no way to go back to double-loaded corridors and bathrooms at the end of the hall after students have been introduced to lavish suites and lazy rivers and so forth. I mean, it's like an arms race, right? Setting aside the absolute most competitive universities, the next tier down and the next tier below that and the next tier below that, the students know that the academic offerings are similar. And so they make their decision based on comfort. And the residence hall is a big part of that. I mean, as a teacher, and I've taught many classes at Rutgers on college architecture and on the architecture of Rutgers, and you know, at one point, one of the students said to me, when I asked, why did you choose to come to Rutgers? He said, well, you know, I'm a business major and I knew that the academics was pretty much the same. So I made my decision based on the football team and the residence halls.
Oh, my goodness.
This is not what you want to hear as a person who's devoted her entire life to the professoriate. But I understand what he's saying. So, but I have also heard that the traditional long corridor is great for networking and great for making friends. So what most residence life people recommend is to put the first year students in the traditional dorms and then let them move into suites once their groups have already begun to form.
Well, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Carla, for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a great experience. I enjoyed your caller's questions very much.
Carla Yanni is a professor of architectural history at Rutgers University. She's the author of the new book, Living on Campus, An Architectural History of the American Dormitory. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. Just ahead, it's On Point here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.